Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World.
An invasion by a revanchist neighboring country seeking territory, resources, and perhaps long-term domination. More noise than actual support from allies. Sanctions. Summit meetings that don't change anything on the battlefield. Great powers lining up on different sides. An out-of-the-blue offer from the Trump administration to solve everything with a deal for rare earth and other minerals. No, I'm not describing Ukraine. I am talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo. Well-armed militaries, backed by Rwanda, have seized key provinces in the country's mineral-rich east. They're threatening to continue their offensive with an ever-changing mix of tribal, political, and economic explanations that seem to be shifting from regional to national ambition. Why should we all care? I think the answer is not only because of the human tragedy that these kinds of wars inevitably produce, but also because the Congo conflict is a microcosm of our time. International borders no longer sacrosanct. 19th century style natural resource grabs, great power confrontations, all with the potential for nasty regional and even global consequences. Mikel Orong is a journalist and an author who knows Rwanda and the Great Lakes region as well as anyone, even if Rwandan President Kagame probably wishes she didn't. She recently published an article in Foreign Affairs, the American Foreign Policy Bible, titled, How Far Will Rwanda Go in Congo? Welcome back, Michaela, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you for having me on again.
I learned a long time ago, never bury the lead. So how far will Rwanda go in Congo?
Yes, well, that was a good title for my article because I sort of failed to answer the question. In a way, it was a kind of exploration of the possibilities. I think there are two possibilities at the moment, the two key alternative visions. The first one is the biggie, and this is one that has been floated by the rebel alliance that is steadily gaining territory in eastern Congo. And they have said that they want to march all the way to Kinshasa, the capital of Democratic Republic of Congo, and topple Felix Tshisekedi, the president there, and his regime. And they're saying that's what they're going to do. So that would be regime change. The smaller, but still very, very ambitious plan, which appears to be taking place as we speak, is that that rebel coalition would end up controlling a huge swathe of land in eastern Congo, which is both fertile and also full of mineral resources and timber and all sorts of other goodies, and that they would then set up a sort of semi-autonomous protectorate that wouldn't really answer to Kinshasa and would be very in line and very easily influenced and very amenable to Rwanda, which is the neighboring country supporting the rebel group.
Let's provide just a bit of the backstory because those are the major elements of the story. Part of this goes all the way back to the genocide in the 90s. But at least from a distance, it seems it's time for everything old is new again. Local warlords, great powers, competition for resources. Is that too melodramatic? This almost sounds, if you were writing a movie about Congo in the 21st century, you'd be doing everything that seems to be happening on the ground.
Yeah, there's a real sense of deja vu for journalists and analysts of my generation, because we feel like we have lived through this movie before. In fact, I've been using the phrase Groundhog Day. There are so many elements that are familiar from when we were much younger covering this region 30 years ago, when what we saw was a rebel movement backed by Rwanda, just like this new rebel coalition is, nominally Congolese. In fact, you know, all its fighting force was coming from the Rwandan army invading Eastern Congo, announcing that it was going to march all the way to Kinshasa, and then doing so and toppling. At the time, of course, it was President Mobutu Sese Seko, and the country wasn't called Congo, it was called Zaire. So, yeah, there is a sense of nothing has changed. And that's actually what makes this so worrying, this whole scenario, because a lot of money, a huge amount of diplomatic effort, a huge amount of weaponry and various peacekeeping forces were sent to Congo to try and make sure that this didn't happen again and that the country kept together as one unit and wasn't sort of torn apart and was at peace and started having normal elections. So we've seen sort of 20 years of peacemaking efforts just unraveling, you know, within weeks. And it's really, really dismaying and very worrying, because I think it could have all sorts of consequences for the greater region.
Seems to me there's at least three parts of an explanation for all of that. One is tribal conflicts that don't quite match, obviously, national borders. One is individual stories, individual drive for power, the great man stuff. And one are all of those resources you mentioned in passing. This is a fabulously wealthy, at least in theory, country, Congo, and in particular, the east of the Congo. Unlimited amounts of gold, tin, something called tantalum, which I'd never heard of before until I started learning more about Congo, tungsten, et cetera, timber. The list goes on. Is this just, is it some kind of witch's brew of those three and maybe other things? Is one driver keeping this alive now 30 years going on, who knows what, how long?
Well, I think the habit has tended to be by the international media and commentator, you know, they've got into this habit of saying it's all about the minerals, you know, there's a slight element of guilt tripping about this, because they say, you know, look at your phone, look at your computer that you're using right now. These were made with these key strategic important minerals that come from Congo, because it's one of the world's major sources. And this is why this conflict is happening. But most people who study the region and this particular conflict will tell you that that's just an element, and it may not even be the prime element. One of the theories, you know, people will say very simplistically, they'll say, well, Rwanda's just going into Congo because it wants to steal those mineral resources. Well, the sad fact is that Rwanda has been hoovering up those resources for years now. They've been smuggled out of Eastern Congo and exported and sold as Rwandan produce for years. So it didn't really need a war to get access to those riches. And so I think whenever, you know, it's definitely a factor, but not the key factor. There is also an ethnic element to it, which you've mentioned, which is that, there is a group of Tutsis, Congolese Tutsis. The Tutsis are this group that from which Paul Kagame comes. You know, he's a Tutsi, his wife is a Tutsi, key members of his ruling administration are Tutsis. He ran a Tutsi-led rebel group that seized power in 1994. So, and he has presented this conflict as, you know, this rebel movement, this rebel coalition called M23 is only in the country because it's protecting the Tutsis who face a second genocide. So he kind of reminds people of the 1994 genocide in which members of the Tutsi minority were particularly targeted. And he'll say they now face a second genocide because they are being harassed, lynched, attacked, victimized. And that's why the M23 is there, and it's protecting them. I think that argument doesn't really wash. And if you look at particularly the area that is now being occupied by the M23 that they have seized over the last month and a bit. It's there are many different ethnic configurations in it, many different communities, and the whole argument of like it's there to protect the Tutsis is becoming thinner and thinner as the weeks go by. So I tend to see it more as a hegemonic issue, an issue of presidential control. I think you have in Rwandan President Paul Kagame, one of Africa's most interesting, most ambitious, most ruthless, and most impressive leaders. And he's a man who leads a very small country of 14 million people, who has always been a bit too big for his own country. And I think if you look at history, this is the fifth time that Rwanda, under his leadership, that the Rwandan army has gone into Congo supporting a Tutsi-led rebel movement. And when he did it in 1997, it led to the overthrow of President Mobutu. He tried to do the same thing again in 1998 and topple the man he had put in place of Mobutu, Laurent Kabila. That didn't work. But ever since then, he's been sort of sending his forces into Eastern Congo. And I think it's really become an issue of his dominance in the Great Lakes region. He is kind of become very sharp elbowed, and he's saying to all the other regional presidents that, you know, I'm the big guy here. I'm the person who decides the future. And when you see something happening for the fifth time running in 30 years, you have to assume that the intent behind it is very serious and probably permanent. And so my assumption is that, as we were talking about earlier, that he's now determined to carve out a sort of area of influence, a protectorate that will be obedient and responsive to his desires and his wishes in future, and not really operating as part of Democratic Republic of Congo.
Let's talk about the other players on the Congolese side. You have the president, Tshisekedi. You've got Kabila, who seems to be back, maybe, perhaps, who knows. You have Corneille Nangaa, who is suddenly out of nowhere a player. Can you talk a bit about that and the interrelations among them and between them and Kagame?
Yes. And these have all shifted. I mean, these are all things that have changed over the years. So just maybe I'll start with Kabila, just to specify. I mentioned earlier, Laurent Kabila, who was the rebel leader supported by Rwanda, who toppled Mobutu Sese Seko in 1997. And within a year, he had fallen out with his backers, Rwanda, Paul Kagame, and they decided they were going to get rid of him just as they had got rid of President Mobutu Sese Seko. And they attempted to overturn him. And that attempt was unsuccessful. It was done by military means, and the whole military operation got bogged down and was very costly towards Rwanda. But very soon after, he was assassinated by one of his own bodyguards. And the assumption has always been, the suspicion has always been, that Rwanda and maybe Angola were behind that assassination attempt. So the Kabila we're talking about now is not Laurent Kabila. It is Joseph Kabila, his son, who took over as soon as his father was assassinated, but took over, had always had very close ties with the Rwandans, had spent a lot of time in Rwanda as a young man growing up. And during his presidency, which lasted a long, long time because he exceeded his term limit and had to be bullied into stepping down by the Western, by the international community eventually, he was always very close to Paul Kagame and seen really as doing his bidding. So eventually he had to stand down under Western pressure. Felix Tshisekedi takes over very much as his anointed candidate. There were huge question marks about the validity and transparency of that election. Felix Tshisekedi himself is the son of a very respected, long-running veteran opposition leader from Congo, Etienne Tshisekedi. Initially, Felix Tshisekedi's relations with Paul Kagame were extremely harmonious. There was the message went out that they were going to be best of friends, and there was no reason to have any tension or any disagreement between the two sides. And so this changed over the years. And what most analysts seem to reckon has happened is that there was a point where Tshisekedi feeling a bit more confident, started to do infrastructural investment schemes, sign contracts with his neighboring countries. He had joined the East African Community. He was signing road construction contracts with neighboring Uganda. The roads, if they had been repaired and built in the way that was being discussed, would have meant that all produce from Eastern Congo would have gone out either via Burundi and Tanzania or via Uganda and not gone through Rwanda, which suddenly meant that a source of sort of both influence, but also, you know, a source of income would have been lost to Rwanda. And I think what most people reckon is that Kagame saw all this happening and realized that he was being cut out of the deals. And this also coincided with a railway project that was under discussion with Tanzania. And he just didn't thought this is unacceptable. You know, I'm the person who decides what happens in the region. And that appears to have really been the trigger. And then we suddenly see this M23, which was an old rebel movement that had been active in the 2010s, reviving and coming back into play with Rwandan backing. I'll just go to the last person you mentioned was Corneille Nangaa. And he's a very interesting character because during the first election that put Felix Tshisekedi in the presidential palace in Kinshasa, there were huge question marks about the results. I mean, the Congolese churches have got together and said, you know, these results do not make sense. You know, they do not jive with what we have at all. You know, churches play a very important role in Congo in terms of sort of trying to protect civil rights. And they said, this doesn't make sense. And Corneille Nangaa was the director of the Electoral Commission. And so he basically signed off on these very, very dodgy election results. And this is not something that the Congolese population has forgotten. In fact, they have repeatedly raised this with him. And, you know, here he is, you know, the nominal head of a rebel movement, which is challenging Felix Tshisekedi. And his line is, well, I've seen the error of my ways. I got it wrong. Yes, I anointed him. You know, when I was running the electoral commission, I anointed him as the president of Congo. But, you know, how wrong I was. And here I am making up for it by leading this rebel group. But obviously that's a position that is quite hard to carry off. So he is the other player in all this. And I think, you know, there are a lot of analogies between him and Laurent Kabila in 1997, in that you have someone who's been chosen seemingly because he is Congolese. Behind him, there are Rwandan forces. There's Rwandan military. There's Rwandan planning, Rwandan's strategic sort of, everything behind him is Rwandan, but there's a Congolese figurehead. And that was the situation with Laurent Kabila, and that seems to be the situation with Corneille Nangaa.
That's a really important point. M23, described as a rebel group, has sort of this image of a bunch of guys in badly dressed uniforms, fatigues in the forest, when in fact it's a very professional-looking army, including thousands of Rwandan, not just soldiers, but equipment, tanks. You see images coming from this war, and it doesn't look like the caricature of an African war out in the jungle. It's really quite professional.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you see any recent photographs or videos taken of M23, you would not think this is a rebel movement. This looks like a regular army. And this point has been made repeatedly by UN groups of experts who have gone in and done 6-monthly reports on what's going on in the region. And they have sort of said, you know, in their reports, this is a rebel movement that operates like a regular army. It's got the same equipment as the Rwandan army. It's got the same gear. It's got the same uniforms. You know, this is basically the Rwandan army. So I think it's increasingly difficult to distinguish between the two. And in fact, occasionally, because the M23 are giving more and more interviews to journalists, you will sort of see you know, the leader of the M23 being interviewed, and behind him there'll be some of his fighters standing there, and they look like, you know, superbly equipped, you know, pristine uniforms. They don't look like rebel, the kind of rebels I've ever seen in Africa. It's a little unclear how many M23 troops now exist. I think one of the figures that was being bandied around a couple of weeks ago was 8,000 troops for the M23, but there are between 8,000 and 12,000 Rwandan army soldiers also operating in the area of captured Congolese territory. So it's a very professional operation, and it doesn't look anything like what African rebel groups normally look like.
The Tilburg Foundation has a deep commitment to encouraging global values-based leadership wherever we can find it. With the Tilburg Leaders Mentoring Leaders program, we're looking to identify and nurture emerging leaders with outsized potential. TLML aims to leverage the Tilburg Foundation's global network to accelerate emerging leaders' growth and impact through one-on-one mentoring. Are you someone, or do you know someone, who should be a part of the TLML program? If so, please apply. Applications will be accepted from March 1st. Go to tilburgfoundation.org for more information. Thank you. Tshisekedi recently met with Kagame. Kagame may have separately met with Kabila. There's rumors around about that. What happens next?
Yeah, there was this meeting in Qatar that was hosted by the Emir of Qatar. And Qatar is a big investor in Rwanda. And they have tried to play a mediating role in various crises that have involved Rwanda. So the two leaders got together and met there and immediately signed up for a supposed ceasefire and the cessation of hostilities. But of course, nothing on the ground has changed. And this is actually a pattern we've seen in this conflict, that ceasefires are announced by the M23. And then the fighting continues regardless. And there's a sort of, you know, there it's gesture politics. You know, it's the M23 wanting to make it look as though they're giving peace a chance, they're giving negotiations a chance. But effectively, one of the key issues we have now is it's not clear who is fighting with any seriousness on the Congolese side. Early on in the conflict, there were two mercenary groups that were being employed by the Congolese government. That they were, in particular, they were running the drone operation on which the Congolese army relied quite heavily. They were disarmed by the Rwandans and deported from the country. We saw a UN force, MONUSCO, which is one of the longest running UN forces in history, also being disarmed and cantoned inside Goma in North Kivu. We saw South African peacekeepers running a Southern African peacekeeping regional force there. They were also surrounded, laid down their weapons after 14 South African fighters were killed and three others also. They were stuck in this humiliating position by the M23 and the Rwandan army, where they basically couldn't do anything, were just cantoned. They've now announced that they're pulling out. The Burundian army, which was fighting on the Congolese side, has slowly been withdrawing from southern Kivu. And so it's left to the Congolese army and what are known as Wazalendo, which is a coalition of local militias who really do look like ragtag African rebel movements, who appear to be extremely demoralized. They're fighting N23 and the Rwandans. But in many cases, they're not being paid, they're not being fed, they don't have decent equipment, they've been cut off from fresh supplies. And so it's really not clear who's doing the fighting on the Congolese side. In this situation, I think, you know, everyone is just watching the M23 seize more and more power, more and more territory, and wondering what happens next. And it does seem to suggest that unless pressure is put on Rwanda, we're certainly going to see that ambition of a sort of semi-autonomous protectorate being solidified and entrenched. Whether then that rebel group does do as it promised it would do and start marching on Kinshasa, I don't know. At the moment, most people are concerned with Kisangani, which is the third biggest city in Congo. It's the city, you know, made famous by V.S. Naipaul in Bend in the River. It's a big city. It's rich in diamonds. It would be an important vantage point because it's on the river. Everyone is wondering whether that is going to be the next to fall. Because the rebels have seized a place called Walikale. They seized it and then drew back, saying they would give peace a chance. But the biggest city after Walikale is then Kisangani.
Let's add the great powers at this point. Rwanda has had good relations with Europeans, especially. China more or less replaced the United States in Congo economically over the years, explicitly in terms of buying out Freeport-McMoRan and the mining concessions. The Russians seem not to be around, although that may or may not be the case. And then, as I said at the top, all of a sudden, out of the blue, the Trump administration shows up with a very Ukraine-like offer to buy rare earths, minerals, which may already be owned by China on the one hand or promised to the Europeans on the other hand. And none of it may matter, in fact, but does it?
Yeah, I think there were definite parallels between the Zelensky deal with Trump, you know, concerning minerals and the possible deal on minerals in Congo. The problem is, you've already highlighted, it's not clear that that these are available to be handed out. It's also not clear really who's negotiating the terms of that deal. There was a recent article in the Africa Report, which was fascinating because it showed that there are four or five different players in Washington who are trying to negotiate this deal. And it's not clear which one has the ear of the president, Felix Tshisekedi, and therefore which one would have the authority to sign off on this kind of arrangement. But it's also very unclear what kind of security guarantees the US would be willing to offer in exchange. What we do know historically is that America, you know, ever since Black Hawk Down, has never wanted to see American soldiers engaged in the African continent, has always wanted to act using proxies. And one of the proxies they were happy to rely on were the Rwandan peacekeepers, who were very, very good at their job and were always willing to step up and take part in UN operations across the continent. So it's really not clear what the Congolese would get in exchange for handing over these minerals, if they even can do so. So I think there's a lot of murkiness around that. It sounds like a fascinating deal, but may prove to be really hard to pin down. I think if you put that to one side, that probably the only thing that will prevent the rebels from continuing their march across the country. There are two elements. One is that they'll overextend. They probably already are overextended, because it's one thing capturing a town. It's another thing then being able to run it and administer it. And you know, they will want to show that they can install law and order, and they're already having problems on that front. There have been some stories of rapes and lynchings and, you know, prison breakouts and nastiness occurring in quite a few of the areas that they supposedly control. They've talked about training up policemen. They haven't been able to deploy them. The banks aren't operating. Trade has ground to a halt. So there are all sorts of sort of structural problems already surfacing. So that's going to be one issue. And then, you know, the other problem is going to be, you know, the attitudes of both Africa as a whole, because Congo is an enormous country which is surrounded by all these African neighbors who may decide they're not that happy about what's going on their border. But also the attitude of the international community. because let's not forget that Rwanda, which backs the M23 and without whom the M23 would not exist, is heavily aid dependent and is run by President Paul Kagame, who very much likes to be invited to Davos, turn up at various red carpet receptions, have, you know, delegates from all over the world attending conferences in his capital, see various soccer clubs. You know, he sponsors all these sports organizations and goes to various sports meetings around the world. He's someone who likes the approbation of the West. And of late, there have been a series of sanctions being announced by the likes of Belgium, by the United Kingdom. The America has sanctioned one of his key ministers. There's also been the EU has come out with a list of Rwandan officials and M23 players that it's sanctioning. So one by one, these sanctions are being unveiled, and he's beginning to feel the sort of cold shoulder of an international community that he's always very defiant. He's always very challenging, but he does care desperately about being admired, respected, and praised in the West. And that praise and admiration is beginning to be turned off.
Let me end with the what if question. What if this time, however, they push on to Kinshasa? What if there is regime change in Congo and it is a regime which is, as Kagame had intended before, really quite, if not controlled by, at least dominated by Rwanda, that he says, okay, I understand the global order is coming apart and the Europeans aren't quite on their game and the Americans are distracted. Now is the time for me to change this. What would be the consequences for Central Africa and maybe beyond?
Yeah. It's hard to imagine. I mean, when Kagame toppled Mobutu, the entire region was very fed up of Mobutu. He was seen as being a destabilizing force, an aging, sclerotic, deeply corrupt president who really represented a previous era, and that, you know, it was time, you know, the region was well rid of him. That, and therefore, a lot of neighboring countries, most of them, got behind the AFDL and Rwanda and did their best to topple him. So it was a joint effort. This time, you're talking about a president who, at least with his second mandate, is seen as being, you know, having been fairly voted in and having a genuine electoral mandate. The West, which again had turned its back on Mobutu in 1997, is very unhappy about what's going on, even if they haven't unrolled and unveiled particularly muscular sanctions. They're very unhappy with what's going on, so they would be likely to give a new Rwandan-backed regime in Kinshasa the cold shoulder. But I also just question whether it would be possible for that kind of regime change to take place. Because as I said, Corne Nanga has huge credibility problems because of his role in sort of helping Tshisekedi win power in what were obviously rigged elections the first time around. I think he's regarded as a bit of a joke by most Congolese voters. Joseph Kabila, who might well end up being the chosen candidate because he's certainly been giving more and more talks and criticizing Felix Tshisekedi and presenting himself as a political alternative. I think he's simply seen as a Kigali puppet, as Paul Kagame's puppet by most of the Congolese population. So I think there would be a real credibility issue with anyone imposed in that way. You can say, what does that matter? But we have seen in Kinshasa before what it's like when you have a deeply unpopular president, because Mobutu in his last years was deeply, deeply unpopular. And it was really a place that was in limbo because, you know, no one was really running anything, and there were constant sort of citywide strikes and constant protests and constant demonstrations. And I don't think anyone would be looking forward to that scenario. But also, yeah, I think if that were to happen, I think it would be very difficult for President Paul Kagame, because he would be seen as someone who is simply a sort of, you know, serial regime changer, you know, someone who seems to think it's within his power to topple neighboring administrations and is quite ready to do that. And many of his neighbors already see him in that light, but it would really cement that opinion. And I don't think that is necessarily territory that he would want to enter.
Michaela, thank you for the conversation. It sounds like we aren't terribly close to the end of this story. It may calm down, as it has pointed out. Rwanda's done this 5 times. It's been 30 years of struggle. The tragedy is, it's almost Shakespearean, the tragedy is that this looks set to continue. Is that a fair bottom line?
Yes, I'm afraid so. I think this is going to run and run. I was looking at my records last week, and it took 6 months for the AFDL to get all the way to Kinshasa in 1997 and overturn Mobutu. I think this, what we're seeing taking place now will probably be slower. I'm hoping it won't get that far. But I think we're going to be in crisis mode for quite a while. And one of the points I try to make when I sometimes, you know, speak to people in Europe and British officials and others is, you know, when you're hesitating in not unveiling muscular sanctions against Paul Kagame, don't forget that this is going to be costing you, because DRC already has 7 million displaced people. In the east of Congo, there's been a huge population of people who've had to, they've been displaced by the M23 military campaign. They were living under tarpaulins. They were catching nasty diseases. The women were being victimized because they were very vulnerable. And they were living off food rations because, of course, they can't till their fields. And that was being paid for by the international community, you know, by the World Food Programme. And it was very expensive, as is supporting a UN force in that area for as long as we have. So Rwanda's misbehavior and its sort of ambitions, Paul Kagame's ambitions, are costing us dearly. It's not just about the fact that he's destabilizing the region. It's also going to cost the international community a huge amount of money to try and patch up the damage that he is creating.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.